This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia on the National Community Radio Satellite. Listen. The Anarchist World This Week, Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. Listen to analysis of local, national, international events. Listen to analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Welcome to this special edition of the Anarchist World This Week. Just in case you haven't noticed, it's the 3rd of December, and two important things happened on the 3rd of December. One, it's the anniversary of the Eureka Rebellion, and this year marks the 171st anniversary of the Eureka Rebellion. And two, it's International Day of Disability. So, obviously, I'll concentrate on the story behind the Eureka Rebellion and its continuing legacy. And if you wonder what anarchism is all about, it's about power and wealth. It's about redistributing power, possibly through direct democratic means, and it's about holding wealth in common and using it for the common good. Because obviously most of the problems we face in the world today are due to inequalities in power and wealth. And as inequalities in power and wealth increase in societies around the globe, what we see is an increasing alienation from structures and institutions which make decisions for people. And as this isolation grows, we see dissatisfaction, and this satisfaction can result in egalitarian reformist revolutionary movements, or it can result in authoritarian, centralised movements. And that's what we're seeing around the world today. But that's for another day. So I'll give you some background to the Eureka Rebellion, then we'll talk about the Eureka Rebellion, then its continuing legacy, and obviously I'll be making a few comments about the role the Eureka flag, and that's right, the Eureka flag plays in Australian society in 2025. Now, while you're listening to this program, I'm actually hosting the Reclaim the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion celebrations in Ballarat. And at this exact moment, I'll be giving out, with the assistance of the Ballarat Trades Halls and Ballarat and Western Region Trades Hall, 6 Eureka Australia Day medals to activists who've made a lasting and continuing contribution to the struggle to create a more egalitarian community in Australia. Now, obviously, if you listen to this program on the 3rd of December, most likely you won't be in Ballarat. But if you do make it to Ballarat by this evening, we're having a Eureka dinner at the Queen's Head Hotel in Ballarat, to which you're all welcome to come to. It starts at 6:30 p.m., and you just pay for your own drinks and food. But if you can't make it this year, put it on your bucket list for 2026 to celebrate the 172nd anniversary of the Eureka Rebellion. So what's this all about? Well, for over 60,000 years, First Nations people in Victoria had been living on this soil, 2,000 generations. And within one generation, we saw the destruction of a civilization which had existed for over 60,000 years, in order that a minuscule minority could make a bit of money. That's the background. Now, a lot of people think that the colonisation process began in Melbourne in 1835 when some squatters from Tasmania entered what is described as Port Phillip Bay and came to an agreement with representatives of the Kulin Nation to access their land. Well, it happened much, much earlier. In 1788, when the first convict settlement was established at Port Jackson, what we saw was the introduction of disease onto the Australian continent, to which First Nations people had no immunity to. Things like measles, smallpox, typhus, tetanus, and the list goes on and on. So by 1835, when Europeans established a permanent settlement in what is now called Victoria, death had decreased the First Nations population. And when Human Hovel crossed Victoria, commenting on the lush grasslands, and I'll talk about that in a minute, they saw many deserted encampments and many survivors of smallpox who had smallpox scars on them. So the First Nations community in Victoria had been directly affected by the colonisation process in New South Wales. Now, the first attempt to colonise Victoria occurred in 1803, where Captain Collins set up a settlement around Sorrento. It didn't last long because they had no access to fresh water. You'd think they would have planned things differently. And then they were ordered to go to Hobart, where they established the first colony in 1803. And we all know what happened in Tasmania to that country's First Nations people. There was a second attempt in the 1825 to set up another settlement at Churchill Island, and that again failed. But in 1835, people on the Three Enterprise entered what is now described as Port Phillip Bay and went about beginning one of the most extreme and savage colonisation processes which has occurred in this country since the beginning of colonisation. Now, local people didn't just rely on managing the land through fire, and as I said, as Human Hovel, you know, crossed Victoria, the grasslands they saw were a direct result of the farming practices which were used by First Nations people to attract animals, to maintain their lifestyle. But only about 20% of their food sources came from animals. Most of their food sources came from murnyong, which is a yam potato type product which occurred all over Victoria, and this provided a staple diet for First Nations people. Now, when the colonisation process began, it began at the same time as we saw the Industrial Revolution begin in England and Scotland and Wales, where the land that peasants had tilled for generations was enclosed. And they were forced into the growing cities to act as factory fodder for industrialists and capitalists who were using the new technological innovations to enrich themselves at the expense of their own people. But not only that, Industrialisation meant a great thirst for raw material. And the raw material that was most wanted was wool. Now, when the settlers first arrived in what is now described as Victoria, they saw these vast grasslands and a competition began for access to water and grass, the essential ingredients to grow sheep. And by 1854, the year of the Eureka Rebellion, 19 years after the colony was established in Victoria, we saw an Aboriginal population, which was about 100,000, reduced to less than 2,000. Not just by disease, but by starvation, because the Mirniong, which they relied on, was pulled out roots and all by the sheep, which were introduced into the colony. The sheep were shorn, the wool was sent back to England, and hey presto, we had a new class of colonialists who relied on three things. Cheap labour, that's convicts, ex-convicts who'd come down to Victoria to work. They relied on three land and three water. And how do you get three land and three water in a land that's been settled for over 60,000 years? You destroy the original inhabitants. You slaughter them. Initially openly, and after the Mile Creek Massacre in New South Wales resulted in the hanging of seven of the shepherds involved, but none of their masters, the war went underground, and we saw some of the most vicious, nasty attempts at eradication of the original inhabitants, who were seen as nothing more than vermin to be rid of in order for the sheep runs to expand and the profits of those who had acquired those runs to be maximised. And let's not forget that the third ingredient was capital, money. So what we saw is nobility, in inverted commas, from England, sending out their third or fourth sons with a heap of money and sheep in order to access land. And by 1854, 720 squatters had illegally acquired every single acre in Victoria at the expense of the original inhabitants and at the expense of their poorly paid workers, freed ticket of leave men and women. Now, in 1850, I think the 1st of January 1850, it could have been 51, Victoria was declared a separate colony and a legislative council was set up to govern the colony. Two-thirds of the members were appointed by the government and one-third was restricted to the squatters because you needed a property qualification in order to stand and to vote. But in 1851, everything changed. Alluvial gold was found in Victoria. Alluvial gold is the type of gold you find on the ground, panning dirt, by creeks. It's not a matter of digging into a hillside, but just using a pan. And obviously, after the failed revolutions which swept Europe in 1848, after the Californian gold fields has petered out, you know, in 1848-49. What after the Chartist movement had failed in England to acquire any of their demands, including universal male suffrage. What we saw is a huge rush of humanity from every corner of the British Empire, every corner of the world, pour into Victoria to make their fortune. The population of Victoria increased within 12 months from 50,000 to over 250,000. As the alluvial gold ran out, people started digging pits, mines, in order to access the gold. But the squatters, concerned that without their cheap labour, they couldn't make those extraordinary profits by exporting wool to England, the perfect export product, didn't need to be looked after, didn't need to be put in barrels. You just wrap it up in a bale and send it off. Decided to pass some legislation in the Victorian Legislative Council, which introduced a mining licence, which was £2 a month. A month's wages for most workers. £2 a month, and you got access to a little area about 3 metres by 5 metres if you were lucky. And they introduced the miners' licence for one good reason. They didn't want their cheap labour to run away to the goldfields to seek their fortunes. Because people who came to the goldfields came with one motive, to make their fortunes. A little bit like buying a Tats Lotto ticket. Lots of us buy Tats Lotto tickets. Only a few, a handful, win the big prize. And the fact is that most of the miners didn't actually make anything or very little. And obviously, although you may have come to this country with a few assets, that money ran out very quickly. But I've got a little bit ahead of my story. So, there were gold mines around the state of Victoria. But the Ballarat goldfields were interesting. The Ballarat goldfields had been established on Wawarong and Dajadaja Warong lands. The Ballarat goldfields were not based on alluvial panning. They were based on digging holes to find gold, because most of the alluvial gold had run out by the time the Ballarat goldfields were established. And by 1854, Ballarat was a sea of humanity. Over 25,000 people lived in a tent city, eking out an existence, fighting the authorities who were keen to drive them back into poorly paid jobs on sheep stations around the country. Now, the Victoria Police were formed in 1853. Most of them were ex-convicts. They were poorly paid. But there was one silver lining to be a member of the Victoria Police. They used to be called Joes, after Joseph Latrobe, who was the first Lieutenant Governor of Victoria. The Joes were able to augment their income because they were promised a share of the fine which was levied on the miners who did not have a miner's licence on them. Now, can you imagine this? No plastic in those days. You got a little paper miner's licence. You got it hidden somewhere in your pants or in your pocket. It's all scrunched up. There are numerous police raids on the Ballarat goldfields looking for these miners' licences. If you didn't have your miner's licence on you, you're actually handcuffed to a tree outside Camp Street where the police station was, the police encampment was, and you're only released after you paid a £5 fine. So you can imagine the anger and the consternation on the goldfields. The interesting thing about Ballarat, a huge tent city which housed over 25,000 miners and their families, the interesting thing was that this little town had four newspapers. four newspapers. Today, in this country, we have one national newspaper, which is dominated by the Murdoch family. Irrespective of the use you use of social media, the fact is most of the garbage that appears on social media as far as news analysis is concerned appears first in the legacy media, which does the work, and the commentary occurs on social media. Four newspapers set up by small-time entrepreneurs who dragged printing presses from Melbourne to Ballarat. The most radical paper was the Ballarat Times. And the editor of the Ballarat Times was Henry Seacombe, of Ballarat fame, and you'll find out why he was infamous later on. So you've got this seething mass of humanity. They're concerned the gold is running out. They're concerned there's no future for themselves in the new colony. And remember, they've sold everything to come here. They're concerned about their family's futures. So what we saw is the formation of what are described as monster meetings, where the Ballarat Times and a number of the other more radical reformist newspapers in Ballarat promoted through posters the establishment of these meetings. And the first monster meeting occurred in Ballarat on the 11th of November, 1854. So next time somebody asks you, why is the 11th of November so pivotal in Australian history, remind them. On the 11th of November, 1854, the Ballarat Reform League was formed, the organisation behind the Eureka Rebellion. That on the 11th of November, 1880, Ned Kelly was hung. And in many regards, and we'll speak about this later, the hanging of Ned Kelly and the creation of the Ned Kelly Gang and its support amongst various segments of the Victorian community can be directly related to the brutality that occurred during the overrunning of the Eureka Stockade by Victoria Mounted Police and the 12th and 40th British Regiments. So you have this seething mass of humanity. They appoint a number of delegates at the monster meeting on the 11th of November to finalise, to organise their struggle. And as many of the people on the goldfields had experience, personal experience of radical protest, whether they were Irish nationalists, survivors of the failed 1848 revolutions which occurred over Europe, or English Chartists who for years had been struggling to influence Parliament to give them universal male suffrage. So the Ballarat Reform League set up a number of demands, including universal male suffrage. And for the next 3 to 4 months, for the next three to four weeks, we saw issues escalate in Ballarat. We saw the murder of Mr. Scobie at Bentley's Hotel. We saw the ensuing riots which occurred where the Bentley's Hotel was burnt to the ground. We saw the arbitrary arrest of 12 individuals who were involved in that protest, and 3 of them were jailed for their participation. We saw the Kangaroo Coroner's Court, which tried to absolve Bentley and his staff from the murder of Scobie. We saw the change of the Lieutenant Governor from Latrobe, who had an experience, he'd been here since the beginning of the colonisation process, to Governor Hotham, who was a naval disciplinarian, who was sent to Victoria to put a lid on the protests which were occurring on the gold fields across Victoria, whether it was in Castlemaine, whether it was in Clunes, whether it was in Bendigo. Each centre had its own issues. Things started off at Rushworth in 1853, where there was a major confrontation between Victoria Police and the Rushworth miners regarding the gold licences. Because inadvertently, the authorities had sent out a proclamation to the Rushworth goldfields that the gold licence would be suspended. And a few days later, that proclamation was revoked because it never occurred. So we've got the colony of Victoria up in arms. And let's not forget that in a frontier society, the police and the military are not the only elements which have a monopoly on the use of force and firearms. In a frontier society, settlers and miners were armed, many armed to the teeth. So you've got this situation where you've got growing anger regarding corruption in the Victorian government, corruption in the Victoria Police, the inability of people to actually leave Ballarat and take up further employment because they have no access to land, because 720 squatters own the land. In the 1840s, the government tried to regulate the issue by issuing a standing order, which divided Victoria, which was now an independent, well, became an independent colony in 1851, into three regions. Those around Port Phillip, there were no squatters. Those in the intermediate districts, which were Gippsland and the Western region, and those in the outer reaches in the Wimmera and the Mallee. And what did the standing order do? It turned the land that had been stolen by the squatters into leasehold title. That's right, leasehold title. So here we have the people involved in the destruction of this country's First Nations people being rewarded by giving leasehold title over land they had stolen. So we've got this melting pot in Ballarat. And on the 29th of November, the Eureka flag was first flown at the Monster Meeting in Ballarat. So how did the Eureka flag come about? What was the Eureka flag about? Those of you who've got a historical bent may want to look at the Eureka flag in the Eureka Centre in Ballarat, the original flag. The story goes that in a tent city, you need some type of identification in order for people to see where you are. Where is the bakery? Where is the brothel? Where is the liquor shop? Where is the tailor? Where can I buy my groceries? So each shop had their own flag. Because in a tent city, you need to know where you're going. So the Eureka Rebels said to themselves, we need a flag. We need a flag. We need to know, people to know who we are, where we are. And there was discussion for a period of time about what would be an appropriate symbol for them. Now, what we saw over time during these discussions is that no agreement could be come to regarding an appropriate symbol. So what happened is, the story goes that one of the delegates was outside the tent relieving himself, as you do, at late night, and he saw the Southern Cross in the sky and he said, "Eureka." He rushed back into the meeting and suggested the Southern Cross. So why the Southern Cross? Now remember, this is the time before mobile phones. It's the time before the internet. There was no lighting of any type apart from candles and fires. So when people gathered in their tents at night after a hard day's work, they would look up in the sky, and what would they see in the sky that they never saw in the Northern Hemisphere? They saw the Southern Cross. So the Southern Cross, to many of the people who had come onto the goldfields, was a symbol of a new life, free of the class divisions and inequalities of the societies they had come from. That was the Southern Cross to them. So the Southern Cross was adopted as their symbol. And that night, three women, including, I think, Anastasia Hayes, and I could be incorrect here, sewed the cloth, sewed the flag. And the stars on the Southern Cross are interesting because they're eight-pointed stars, not seven-pointed stars as we see on the Australian flag on the Southern Cross, but eight-pointed stars. And why there are eight-pointed stars? Because it's easier to create an eight-pointed star flag because you can fold it over and halve your work than trying to work out something geometrically. And because there was a lack of material on the goldfields, the flag was made from women's underwear. A great story, but true. So on the 29th of Mr. Humphrey, had been elected as the leader of the Ballarat Reform League by the delegates, and he believed that you could change the government opinion through discussion and moral force. At the same time, because of the increasing brutality of the Victoria Police and the British military, which had been sent to try to avoid a revolt, what we saw was an increasing preference for physical force. So after the Monster meeting on the 29th of November, after their overtures by their delegates had been repeatedly rebuffed by the Hoffman-led Victorian government, at the end of the meeting, those diggers that supported physical force gathered at the base of the newly erected flag. And remember, swearing an oath to a foreign flag in those days was described as high treason. And the penalty for high treason was death by drawing and quartering. And just in case you don't understand what this was about, I'll give you a description. You may want to put your hands over your ears. So first of all, you are hung. Strangled, hung. You're just lifted off the ground until you could hardly breathe and you lost consciousness. When you lost consciousness, you were taken down and placed on a table. Then you were cut from sternum to pelvis. And remember, these are public executions. These are executions which are meant to deter people from, subverting the power of the sovereign. Now, because it's very difficult for thousands or hundreds of people at a public execution to see what's going on, the intestines of the living person to be executed are lifted into the air, and then they are burnt. The stench of the coal on burning would go through the crowd to give them a lifelong lesson about what happens to people who try to usurp those that have been appointed by God to rule them for all eternity. If you are lucky, The executioner would then cut your heart. If you're unlucky and you're a leader of a rebellion, while still alive, while being disemboweled, you had horses attached to each limb and they tore off your limbs. This is drawing and quartering, and I'm not making this up. This is the reality many radicals endured because they questioned the rule of the sovereign. So here we have these 500 miners that had gathered, those that believed in physical force that had gathered at the end of the monster meeting on the 29th of November at the foot of the newly raised symbol, the Southern Cross. They said this oath. Peter Laylor, who by then had had a major impact on the physical force brigade, jumped on a tree stump and recited this oath. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly and fight to defend our rights and liberties. Now, this is an extraordinary oath in 1854. We, everybody, not just white people or black people or Protestants or Catholics or Muslims, we, the people on the goldfields, we swear by the Southern Cross. Now, the Southern Cross isn't a religious reference. It's a reference to the fact that they have come to a new land where they can see the Southern Cross for the first time in their lives. And the Southern Cross reminds them they are in a new land. And in this new land, they want to create a society free of the inequalities and brutalities of the societies they left in Europe. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other. Solidarity. People understood that if they resisted as individuals, they'd be arrested, fined, jailed, killed. What if they came together as a group that was armed? It was much more difficult to contain them, to rule them. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties. Irrespective of the fact they had no representation, irrespective of the fact they had no say in the type of government decisions were made, they believed they were born with inherent rights and liberties which they were willing to fight and die for. So by the 2nd of December 1854, we saw the establishment of the Eureka Stockade. It was only about an acre in sight at the Eureka Gold Diggings. And on that same Saturday, we saw over 1,500 armed miners drill, waiting for an attack from the colonial authorities. They had no illusions. 24 hours previously, there'd been shots exchanged as Victoria Mounted Police attempted to raid the goldfields to collect more fines for people not having their licenses. People burnt their licenses as a form of public protest. Now, everybody believed, and this is a problem, everybody believed that the authorities will not attack them on God's Day, Sunday. But on the 3rd of December 1854, 104 miners, only about 50 who were armed, were attacked by 90 Victorian Mounted Police and two divisions of British troops, the 12th and the 40th Regiment. And they overran the encampment within 15 minutes. Now, there are many stories regarding what happened on that fateful morning. We saw the troops and the mounted police march from Camp Street, the very spot where Ballarat and Western Regions Trades Hall is now established, down to the Eureka diggings, and at 4 a.m. they launched their attack. What happened in the next few hours is one of the most shameful periods in Victorian history. Not as shameful as the extermination of First Nations people, but in a shameful episode. The soldiers were relatively disciplined. They pulled down the flag. They trampled on the flag. But didn't go outside the stockade. As the flag was being pulled down, the mounted police continued their attack, slaughtering injured miners. Women jumped the stockade fence, which was basically made out of old carriages. They crawled through the carriages and they draped their bodies over men they had never seen, who'd been bayoneted or shot, who were dying, to prevent them from being executed. The Victoria Police believed this was the time for revenge, and for the next 3 hours they roamed up to 5 kilometres from the Eureka stockade site, slaughtering people indiscriminately. Over 50 people died that night, that morning. Many formed the Pikemen's Brigade. Now, the pikemen were miners, about half Irish, who held handmade pikes, pikes that had been built in the Eureka stockade by the blacksmith, and they stood their ground as over 240 British troops advanced towards them, shooting their muskets, and as the mounted police raced towards them. They stood their ground, 30 of them. 15 died in a hail of bullets. Many of the others were injured. But this gave the rest of the miners in the stockade a chance to run into the tent city surrounding the stockade and save themselves. The next day, martial law was declared. The government believed that it had all finished. They'd sent all the troops they had under, I think, General Nichols, to the goldfields in Ballarat, forgetting about Warrnambool, Clunes, Castlemaine, Bendigo, Geelong and Melbourne. There were protests. The government realised it only had 37 troops left in Melbourne to guard the Treasury. They were sent to guard the Treasury. 1,500 special constables were appointed to maintain order. But the whole state was on the verge of rebellion. And the governor Hotham began to understand there was no military solution to what was essentially a political problem. So within a few months, we saw the two leaders of the Ballarat Reform League, Mr. Humphrey and Mr. Laylor, elected as representatives for Ballarat in 1856. Universal male suffrage was introduced. Every other demand was accepted. 13 of the miners had been arrested and taken to Melbourne, where they were starved for months, for a trial, which began in February 1855 at the Victorian Supreme Court, where John Joseph, a black man, a freed slave from New York who'd come to Victoria to make his fortune, was tried. And a white jury of his peers found he was innocent, although there were many eyewitnesses who claimed that he shot Captain Wise as Captain Wise rode into the Eureka stockade, and Captain Wise was the deputy commander of the troops, and he died of his war wounds 6 weeks later. The jury acquitted him. He was chaired through the streets of Melbourne, a freed slave from New York. Mr. Sorensen, a Jew, was acquitted. Mr. Hayes, an Irish nationalist, acquitted. Mr. Campbell, McFeef Campbell, a black American from Jamaica, acquitted. And within a few months, every one of the 13 that was tried for high treason was acquitted by a Melbourne jury. And obviously, the government knew its time was up. Governor Hotham died a broken man on the 31st of December, 1854. The Commission of Inquiry, which was held into the Eureka Rebellion, highlighted the role Victoria Police played in the deaths that occurred. And the tragedy was nobody was disciplined, nobody was charged, and those same police officers continued to hold positions of authority in those communities, whether it was Ballarat or Beechworth or Childers, and the list goes on and on. So we saw the very people who murdered the rebels continuing to have positions of authority in Victoria. So no wonder we saw the rise and rise and the popular support of the Ned Kelly gang. But that's another story. So what are the central elements? What are the central elements of the Eureka Rebellion? What do we celebrate on the 171st anniversary of the Eureka Rebellion? Well, Eureka Rebellion is based on four principles which you will not read about or see or hear in most accounts. They are based on four principles which are as important today as they were 171 years ago. They are based on direct action. People took up arms to protect their liberties. Direct democracy. They used a direct democratic delegate system to organise their struggle and to interact with the government of the day. They believed in solidarity. They worked together, not just to abolish the mining licences, but to break the monopoly the squatters had on the land. And this was an international movement. All creeds, all religions, all races. The ideology behind it was, we don't care what your colour is, what your religion is, what your political opinion is. As long as you oppose those that have got the foot on our neck, you are welcome to be part of this movement, which is an extraordinary thing to say in 1854, which was a period of intense racism around the world. So direct action, direct democracy, solidarity, internationalism. These concepts are included in the Eureka Oath. Internationalism. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other, solidarity, and fight to defend our rights and liberties, direct democracy and direct action. Here we have the four essential elements of the Eureka Rebellion. The Eureka Rebellion didn't end on the 3rd of December 1854. By 1857, the government, which hadn't been elected by universal male suffrage in the Legislative Assembly, was about to pass legislation which would have turned the leasehold title of the squatters into freehold title, which means they would have owned every acre of Victoria. This was the Haines initiative. It passed in the Legislative Assembly, but was rejected by the Legislative Council because the squatters wanted more. Interestingly, in 1857, Humphrey, the leader of the Moral Force group within the Ballarat Reform League, opposed the bill. Peter Laylor, who had become a mine owner by then, approved the bill. He was derided in Ballarat, ridden out of town, and the authorities had to find a Conservative seat so he could retain his seat in Parliament. And he had a glorious career in Parliament. If you've got the time to walk up and down the main street in Parliament, there are 19 monuments, not one to the Eureka Rebellion, except monument number 19, where you see Mr. Laylor in his Attorney General's wig and gown smile at the people of Ballarat. They should have pulled his statue down years ago. Now, this year, as in previous years, despite protests from council, despite protests from authorities, we will combine with Ballarat and Western Regions Trades Hall to hold this year's Reclaim the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion celebrations. We will gather at 4 a.m. to mark the moment. Those of you who are listening to this program may have listened to the direct broadcast this morning from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. At 6 a.m. we have a communal breakfast. Bring food and drinks to share. 10 a.m. we meet at Bakery Hill to present 6 Eureka Australia medals to activists who've done the hard work, who have been the force that has created change, people who've not respected by society, who have no understanding of where the reforms we enjoy today have come from, what that struggle has meant, the personal struggle to these individuals. They will receive a Eureka Australia medal. 2 nominated by Ballarat Trades Hall and 4 by the Reclaim, the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion Celebrations Group. At 11:30 a.m. we'll meet at the old Ballarat Cemetery at the mass grave to pay our respect to the 50% of the miners who died on that day who were buried in that mass grave. And we'll also walk across, look at Scobie's graves, Humphrey's grave, the grave of the 6 soldiers that were buried in individual plots. They all participated in the same events. We will look at the monuments that have been established. We will look at the words that are written on them, and we will understand that propaganda has existed from time immemorial. In 171 years, the Ballarat City Council has never flown the Eureka flag on the main flagpole above Ballarat City Hall, even during the 150th anniversary celebrations in 2004. They are ashamed of the rebellion. They use the symbols of the rebellion to promote themselves. Businesses across Ballarat use the symbols but do nothing to celebrate the day. We celebrate the day. And we celebrate the day for one very good reason: to remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice and to honour them by remembering the 4 principles of the Eureka Rebellion. Direct democracy. Direct action. Solidarity and internationalism. And even if you can't make it today, hold the little ceremony in your part of Australia, even if you go out on the footpath in front of your home with a few friends and your family and recite the Eureka Oath. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties. I look forward to you listening to the Anarchist World this week, next week, on your local community radio station, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, Dr. Joseph Toscano, convener of the Reclaim the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion Celebrations Group, convener of the Anarchist Media Institute. Happy Eureka Day to every single listener.
Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction.
An analysis you'll never hear anywhere else. Anarchist World this week. Australia's sacred cow slaughterhouse. 10 a.m. every Wednesday. Listen to the Anarchist World this week for an up-to-date analysis of local, national and international events.
Poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.